Every trail runner needs a torch. Petzl.com makes the best ones. You know, it's in the northern hemisphere. It is still in the wintertime. We have long nights. It's dark out there a lot of the times that we're going out there and running, right?
Absolutely.
And in some of the parts of the northern hemisphere, it's a little chilly. And so it's nice to have a bright, warm glow of a torch.
So, Scott, is that why you always have me follow you, so I can cast my warm beam on you, on your back of your legs?
It helps. We are fans of the reactive lighting that you can find in the Now and the Tika RXP.
I had yesterday a person that I was introducing this torch to, and we went into a dark room, and I had such fun just showing how this reactive lighting, one, how it lights up the room, but two, how it works from looking down and looking up. It was a fun demonstration.
So if you don't know what reactive lighting is, it's a sensor in the headlamp itself that reacts to where you're looking. So if you look down in front of you, it casts a broad spectrum of light, so you can see all the whole perimeter, a panorama, if you will, of your conditions. If you look up and you look out, it automatically changes the beam to a spotlight that goes forever.
Right.
So go
at the speed of light. In fact.
Yeah. Petzl TED torches, the speed of light.
Go to Petzl.com and join the tribe, the torch-carrying tribe.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra-running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
This might be one of the most interesting podcasts ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing. There's a bunch of, like, old brothel hookers, like, buried out here.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Sally McRae.
I'm Zach Bitter.
I'm Ann Trason.
And here we sit. We're in the midst of some real talent here, Sally McRae.
We're also sitting in Ann's house, which is super exciting.
It's very, very cool. And we're here to discuss a few things. One of the items is, how do you run 100 miles in 11 hours and 40 minutes? That's a topic we want to discuss with Zach. And what kind of nutrition does he use to make that happen? And I think our bullet points here to talk about, well, those are the bullet points. We didn't prep much more than that for this podcast.
People, Don did not prep. And I think there are a few more bullet points that we'll be discussing tonight.
At the end.
King of tangents.
At the end, we'll have many bullet points we could list. So welcome, Zach. Let's talk a little bit about some of your accomplishments. And in my preparation, I had them printed out. And it was a long list. I had to reload my printer for all your accomplishments, and somehow I left them at home. So let's talk about some of the things you've done. You have some course records. You've run fast at some 50-mile races, some marathons, some 100-mile races. Let's talk about those.
He's the U.S. American record holder for the 100-mile.
That was on one of
them. Which is pretty awesome.
Yes, yes. So tell us about a few of your accomplishments.
Sure.
Where you started and what's going on.
Yeah, I got to feel a little guilty that some of my most notable things are on flat pavement or on a track, with this being a trail running podcast. But I'll share them either way.
Yeah.
I guess the most recent accomplishment was my 100-mile race at Desert Solstice, where I ran 100 miles in 11 hours, 40 minutes, and 55 seconds.
Wow. What is the average pace per mile?
It's just a shade over 7 flats, so like 7:55.
And we've all told the story how long it takes us to run a long race. And people hear the number and they go, well, I can run that. And then we have to back up and say, well, we have to sometimes take some fuel in and we have to stop for some aid. And in 100 miles, you may have to use a restroom. And all that gets put into your per-minute mile pace. And
sure.
When I think of your 7-minute, I'm thinking, how fast was he really running to average that 7 minutes?
It was certainly a lot faster at mile 15 than it was at 95, I'll tell you that.
Nice point.
Yeah, so I mean, the nice thing about the track and what's one of the reasons why I've fixated on it a little bit in the last few years is because you can really run and do very little else, because you have all your aid very readily available. Like even if you have to stop and use the bathroom, like there's a porter potty in lane 3, and so you can pull out and pull back in pretty quickly. Whenever you want to take in fuel or something, you have a crew and a main aid station. You ask for it, 400 meters later, you have it. So from that, like from a logistical standpoint, it's a dream. From a like excitement standpoint, I suppose it's about as monotonous as you can get, though. So yeah. Playing like mind games and trying to put yourself in a position where mentally you're not on the track is kind of a strategy that I feel is very valuable in a race like that.
Because I can totally understand starting at Squaw and running to Auburn or Wrightwood and going to Pasadena. It makes sense to me, point A to point B, but you're doing a big circle. How do you
see where you're going the entire time.
Yeah, and that's good and bad. So it's good in the sense that, like, if you're trying to hit a time,
yeah,
and you can be really dialed in. Like at Desert Solstice, they had a timing chip, so I could see every lap exactly what pace I was on that lap, what my overall distance, overall pace was, and all this information, which is great. But like you said, you don't always want to know that every lap, because if I was looking at that for 402 times, then that would have gotten pretty fatiguing mentally.
Yeah.
So like one of the things I did differently training for this one that I hadn't done in some other track events was I tried to find ways to get myself in a position where I did not feel like I was running on the track.
Hmm.
And I feel like it worked really well through about 70 miles. But then I started kind of slipping back on my pace. And what I noticed is once you have to really focus to hit your splits is when you can't really separate yourself from the track as easily. And then you're kind of seeing every lap then. And that's when it kind of gets really hard mentally and physically.
Yeah, I've got to ask that. How do you maintain your sanity going in a big circle? Do you get to change directions at will? I think that would be a good rule.
Yeah.
You know?
That's 400 yeah. times around the track.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's... so they switch. At most timed events on tracks, they'll switch every 4 hours. Uh-huh. That's pretty traditional, like a benchmark, I guess. So you're always looking, especially as you get close, like within an hour of a turnaround, that you start using that as like a benchmark or mm-hmm. something to aim for. But you're definitely looking for those little things along the way. Because just like a trail race, if you start trying to envision the entire thing, like even if you're doing Western States, if you're thinking of Auburn at even at Forest Hill or heaven forbid at Squaw, then you're getting yourself into a very big problem because you're not going to be able to get your head around that quite as easily. So things as simple as like, all right, in 20 minutes, I'm going to grab a bottle of whatever fuel I'm taking in and then just focus on that and don't think about anything after that until you get to there. And doing little things like that is kind of a mind game you can play to try to break up the monotony a little bit.
So tell us a little bit about your preparation for that then. What did, in your training, did you really have to be very precise with your nutrition? And then, of course, how you were just going about your training anyway. I mean, would you mm-hmm. go out for 200 lap training runs?
Yeah, so it's kind of what I've seen is a slightly a fine line. Like you definitely want to do like race specific training, just like anything. You want to have a lot of your key workouts on the territory that you're going to be racing in or in a similar type environment. So I did a lot of track work. But I also made sure that I wasn't on the track too much because the last thing I wanted was to step onto the starting line and be, oh, great, I got to go around this oval again.
Yeah.
So I guess my key workout that I would do a few times would be I live about a 20-minute jog away from one of the tracks in Davis. So I would run there, and then I would do like a 12-mile run where I would slowly progress down in pace, and then I would jog back as kind of like a cool down. So I would do about 12 miles on the track and just kind of get a feel of what it was like. I would say though, the thing I would focus on most during those wasn't necessarily like the specific pace I was hitting as much as it was practicing ways to kind of mentally do those type of workouts or be on the track for that long. Cause the boredom is really the biggest thing that'll come and get you. So being able to almost have like an out of body experience where you're not like really even acknowledging that you're
why didn't
on
you
track.
Listen to podcast? I did a 12-hour and I listened to baseball games. Yeah. It was awesome.
Did
you Oh, yeah. It was like with the Walkman thing. It was really heavy, but it was awesome.
Yeah.
There were like two double headers.
What 12-hour was this?
This was one in Hayward, and they had to write down every lap.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. They used to, because I'm a dinosaur, that's before the chip.
Stop.
No, really.
They still have some like that, so don't feel.
Yeah, no, they had to write down, but I was unhappy because I was just listening to the game. I could have. I didn't need an Autobot. They were really good. The Giants won.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You remember.
I remember
every inning of that game, I suppose.
It was great.
Extra innings.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of them did. I mean, there were like two double headers, and that basically took up the 12 hours.
That's awesome.
And I
That's
definitely
really
listen
idea.
To music. I haven't tried podcasts yet during the event itself, but I do that a lot in training, so maybe that's something I should try down the road. Maybe that's the key to PRing next time is the podcast.
Oh, I think podcasts or like some mystery books. I loved like some mind-numbing, like.
And this is for like the hamster wheel type.
That's
races.
A hamster. That's what I call them. Hamster yeah. head races. Yeah, they're definitely hamster head races.
So let's talk about that with everybody at the table about disassociation. Really removing yourself from where you're at, but still staying plugged into: do I need nutrition? Do I need to drink? What is my pace? But how do you separate yourself from this quote unquote boredom or relentless round and round, or even on a trail point to point? We still sometimes need to extract ourselves from where we're at. And does anybody have a thought about that?
I just try and stay in the now moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And no disassociation at all for you.
I don't like to disassociate. No? Nope. I want to know where I'm at and how I'm doing. So I'm always asking myself. I kind of have like a little boring. Maybe it's because I'm boring. That's it.
I can't believe you just called yourself boring. You're not boring at all.
If you're boring, then you don't get bored. How's that?
but to your point, I think you need to be plugged into the moment, but still somehow remove yourself from the next loop around this track. Because I think that's what you're saying, Zach. There's kind of a point that you need to somehow not be right there, but still be present.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Makes sense at all.
I guess the easiest way to say it is you don't want to be counting down from 402 all the way to the end, because then it would just become
that's you. But you know, I was just reading, what was it, like Hal Korner's book or something, and like, yeah. I always tell people you don't want to get to halfway in an ultra, like 50 miles, and say, wow, I've only gone halfway. And his book says that can be motivating, and I'm like, whoa, I didn't ever think of it that way. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think we're all, you know, we are all naturally motivated by different things.
Yeah,
exactly.
And I think there are points in races where sometimes you do have to get outside of yourself. But I agree with Anne. I like to be very present, and I have a very, I guess this is maybe the boring part, a very boring, not mantra, but a routine that I go through to stay present. Where I'll be like, okay, what's my head doing? What are my shoulders doing? Are my shoulders relaxed? Where are my arms? And that I can repeat that over and over again. Like, are my feet landing right under the center of my body mass? And I can repeat that for hours.
Yeah.
And it keeps me occupied because I'm so concentrated on every movement. But it can also be exhausting because it's just – but you're in every step of the race. I think – I just did the road marathon last weekend, and the goal was just to kind of find a nice sweet spot heart rate that we could kind of run forever in. And it was a pace that I felt like, and especially just being on the road, I felt like, yeah, this is it's a little boring because you're not really like pushing, and you're not running like you're not racing, you know, like front of the pack. So you're just kind of like trying to stay happy. And so one thing that I do like to do when I'm in that kind of weird situation where it's like, I'm enjoying the running, but like, I really want to be going faster. I really want a different outcome is it had a lot of out and backs. So I just start talking to people. Good job. You know, you start cheering for people and I feel like sometimes even if you're hurting, like in a race or even if you're on a long run, it helps to talk to people. It gets your mind off of yourself. But I think if you're racing, you do have to be so in tune to what it is that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think that is a personal thing. I think you have to find what motivates you. What is it that keeps you going? So if it's a baseball game, oh my gosh, I could not listen to a baseball game. Like, shoot me now.
That would be harder than the hill.
Yes.
Not another inning.
Yes.
So let's talk about, go ahead, Zach.
I was just going to say, I think it's interesting that I think like there's probably so many different variations of how people go about these things. And that just adds to the mental aspect of the sport and why, mm-hmm. like, as you kind of get further and longer into these distances, it becomes more and more of a mental, a mental thing, as opposed to just going out there and physically overcoming something.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Going around the track, talk about some of the obstacles. I've got to think just a flat course that turns left for 201 times has got to wear on the body in different ways that as we run down a trail, we get hit with all kinds of things. We have to step differently, step long, step short. We're climbing, now we're going downhill. What a gift to get to have a variety of different running styles throughout these X number of hours or miles. I think going around a track would just beat you up in ways that would be tougher than a trail run.
Yeah, so I think that's the stuff I've learned the most of about these events was getting prepared for the track specifically. When I was living in Wisconsin the majority of my life, I did a lot of flat concrete running. Mm. So I definitely have the base in the background of that, like, smaller muscle groups getting hit constantly, much more frequently than what you would see running on, like, undulating terrain or a lot of up and downhill type stuff where you're using a more holistic muscle approach than you are running on the flats. So, I mean, that definitely works to my advantage. What I needed to really focus on when I started doing some of these track races was, like you said, the turning. What I notice is when you're turning at, like, a pace that is a little faster than what you're used to running at, then it really can start to creep up on you, and you might get some, like, weird imbalances or injuries and stuff like that that you wouldn't get by running even on a flat linear plane. So being able to go and do some of those faster workouts that I did on the track was, I think, really key to getting those muscles in a place where they needed to be. And then even differentiating from the direction, because the nice thing about switching directions is it gives you benchmarks to aim for, and it does kind of switch things up a little bit, but you need to be ready to be able to turn both ways. And for me, going out there for just under 12 hours, I was going to be going counterclockwise for just shy of 8 hours and clockwise for 4. So when I was planning workouts specific to the race, I actually tried to break it down that way. So I was turning clockwise 2/3 of the time and counterclockwise 1/3 of the time. And when I spent time on the track.
We'll talk about race specific training, right? That's that's really getting into it.
Did you do long workouts on the track? Would you go and, like, run 25 miles on the track?
No, I didn't do any that long on the track. I think the furthest I went was maybe 15 miles on the track at one time. But there were days where I would do, like, 3 or 4 days in a row where I would get on the track for, you know, 10 plus miles. So,
and what was that like when you did your long, you know, 15 miles on the track? Would you finish and ask yourself, or, like, wonder, like, why am I doing this?
402 laps is coming up in the future.
Well, I think one of the things that I started to really kind of enjoy about it and that helped with that was I started thinking of, like, what running is. And really what I kind of came to was running on a track or on a flat surface is mundane, and it's very, like, one-dimensional, but it's as pure as it gets in terms of running.
It's very pure. I mean, when you get into that groove, because I've done some of this track stuff,
she has world records on the track, and she's like, I've done some of this track stuff.
I've done some track stuff before.
But you just get in, it's beautiful.
It is, and it that's...
You really feel like you're floating.
Right, yep.
You do.
Once you find that, like, sweet spot that you're just going.
And I would say when I went on the track in training, that's what I was looking for more than I was anything else, was getting myself into a place like that, because I knew if I could get in a place like that where it felt pure, it felt like you were just floating, would be where I would knock off the most miles without it feeling like I was actually doing something like a burden or something that was hard to do.
Mm. Did you use a heart rate monitor? Because that's the time I used a lot of heart rate monitors, was doing the track, because it would just say you're slowing down.
Yeah, I didn't do a ton with heart rate monitor.
Not really. I lived with my heart rate monitor I did stuff like that. I mean, yeah.
I've started to look at some of that data. Like, I did some monitoring and looking at it afterwards just to see, like, well, why was my heart rate higher this time, although my pace was the same? Or why was my heart rate lower this time with my pace being the same? And just to try to gauge recovery and things like that. But, yeah, it's definitely an interesting, like, feedback piece that can be valuable and something I'll probably use more of as I go forward.
Well, also you learn more in the modern age where you can see your pace every mile and you have right. people like writing everything down. You're like,
you need to use heart rate. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what I would use.
Yeah.
So did you use heart rate at this last at Desert Solstice? Did you have your heart rate monitored?
No, I didn't. I probably should have just so I could see like how it was affected throughout the course of the race. But I guess I'll say that I left it out because then I can have an excuse to do another one and collect that heart rate data.
Oh my God. So you do want to do that again. You want to get back on the track.
I definitely do. Like, to
well, he has to get under 7 minute miles. Are you kidding? I mean, it's like, okay. And no, honestly, it's sort of like, oh, when's someone going to break 2:10 for marathon? Well, Zach, when are you going to break 7 minute miles for 100 miles?
Seriously, step it up.
It is. Yeah. I think the intriguing to go back to that purity thing is that I know like next time I step onto a track, like nothing changes. Like it's going to be exactly the same for the most part. I mean, if it's outside, you could have some weather issues, but there's some of these events now where you can even regulate that by doing indoor tracks. So knowing like that everything there is pretty much consistent over time, that you can see like it's complete exposure, like during the event, because if you slow down 2 seconds, you slow down 2 seconds because that lap did not change one bit. It's not like, well, I went uphill this time, so I was slower. I went downhill this time, that's why I was faster. You know exactly what's happening by looking at that stuff. So for me, in terms of like one big thing, one reason I do this sport is because I want to see where my limits are, and I want to see like where I can go personally and what my body will allow me to do. Mm-hmm. And the track is like such a good measurement tool for that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so did you check your time every time you went around the track, or did you check in every mile, or did you, you know, what did you do to try to keep that monitored?
I would look at it occasionally to kind of get an idea of like what a lap felt like at a certain effort. So I was certainly aiming for certain like split times. So I would look and see if I was in that range, and if I was in that range, I would kind of like connect that to the effort I gave, and then I would just kind of hold that effort for a while. But then I also realized that as you get further and further, certain efforts are going to be slower. You know, mm-hmm. you're gonna
wasn't your crew, because what my crew did for me when I would do these is they would like tell me if I'm slowing down, because sometimes, you know, maybe the baseball game got too exciting and I'd pick it up, or
the seventh inning stretch,
like you'd be like,
stretch out.
So they were really on making sure, like, you know, if the pace slowed down, like, so I don't know if you use, like, to me, they were invaluable.
Yeah, I would, especially
can you imagine asking, did your person, like, they were out there for 12 hours. Yeah. It's like, yay.
I think at this event, my crew was a little less willing to share that information because I had that at my fingertips if I wanted it. So they probably thought, well, if he wants to know, he'll look. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't want to know, he won't look. So they kind of probably left that to my decision making. But I did do a race on the track about a year and a half ago, or maybe even more by now. I can't remember. But where it was, they were penciling, writing it in. And that one, it was like you kind of needed to ask or have someone tell you, especially if you wanted to know, because otherwise you just didn't know. Like, am I going the same? I mean, you could take splits yourself, I suppose, on like a stopwatch or something to kind of gauge it. But you know, you might feel like, oh yeah, I'm going the same pace as I was 2 hours ago, and in reality you're going 10 seconds a lap slower because of just breakdown and, you know, the wearing down on you.
So you set the American record. What was the American record before you went out there?
So the American record before was 11 hours and 47 minutes. Oh, wow. And it was actually, I had set that in 2013 at the same event.
So you've done this twice and you want to do it again.
Well, I've actually done it like 5 times, I think. So I did Desert Solstice in 2013. And then I went to South Carolina and did a track event that I actually had went there to do a 24-hour. And I guess at that time I was a little more like into like trying out what the 24 hour is, whereas now I'm kind of I've kind of stepped back and think that's something I maybe will do later on in my career when I'm not necessarily as fast at the shorter ultra distances. But regardless, I went out there for that and ended up doing 200 kilometers before I had some Achilles tendonitis issues, so I pulled the plug at 200 kilometers. But then I went to Alaska to try to break the world record for 100 miles, which is 11 hours and 28 minutes. And they had this race up in Alaska called 6 Days in the Dome, where they had people doing everything from what I was doing, trying to go for a fast 100-mile time, to people seeing how far they could get in 6 days.
Hmm.
Yeah.
On a track.
It was cement too. Days. It was like,
yeah, it was
really
hard. It was a hard track.
It was a hard track. Yeah. Cause I had friends that were doing like the 6 day.
Mm-hmm.
6 days.
Inside.
Yeah.
On a track.
So the interesting thing about that, I don't want to digress too much, but that used to be like super popular where they would do like 6 day events in Madison Square Garden.
No, that's
like
the back into the 1880s. 1800s. But, yep. They did the pedestrian races and they'd bet on people. It was awesome.
Yeah, I'm sure. Like,
the I mean, I wasn't alive then. It seems like
you said you were a dinosaur earlier.
I'm a dinosaur.
You are not a dinosaur.
But they used to have cyclists. You
are not
allowed
to call
yourself that
anymore.
They used to have not only were they running, but there were cyclists also. So talk about just mad chaos.
Just
mad
three-ring circus.
Yeah, three-ring circus.
And everybody wants the inside lane.
Because Zach had, there was probably limited people who they get invited to this thing, right?
At the Desert Solstice is like 21, I think.
So that's like, because when I did the 12-hour, there was like, can't remember, like 100. And you're always in the third lane.
For sure. Oh, and I think that was the
really?
The hardest thing.
That's a game changer.
Well, not all the time, but you know, there are people and
you're
like,
passing. Yep. And
just because you're running like 7-minute miles doesn't mean you get the inside lane.
Right. In fact, track protocol for these events is that you pass on the outside.
Yeah.
So... Mm-hmm. We did some calculations with that at this last event I did, and it was kind of between 1 or 2 miles extra that I probably did from going into lane 2 and 3 passing people. I would guess closer to 1 than 2, but you know, somewhere maybe near 1.5. And you kind of know that getting into it, because I've done a few of these now, knowing that unless you set up an event where it's just a fast 100-miler or there's much less people on the track, you're going to be doing a little bit extra. So.
Or their puddles. The one I think I did that was in Santa Rosa, there were big puddles. So the first lane wasn't, it rained the whole time.
Yeah. Hit that puddle 400 sometimes.
No, it was like, you're not going, they were big puddles too. So it was like, you know what, you couldn't run in the first lane.
Oh, wow.
You couldn't.
So you were passing people, obviously. Mm-hmm. Did you use that as a chase this person down, or use that as a marker to help motivate you? Because I think that would be a good thing to cite on.
Not as much to like pass them, as much as like what Sally was saying before when she's talking about some of those out and backs where you talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if like a quick like good job or something, and then they respond.
Yeah.
Is a huge stimulus when you're thinking of something as monotonous as running around a circle on the track. So I think especially on the early stages where your energies are still pretty high with the relative pace, like talking to people within reason, or you know, encouraging each other and stuff is a huge motivator to kind of, you know, just get your mind off exactly what you're doing for a little
bit.
Did
anyone ever pass you?
Or can you tell?
Well, yeah.
No, I don't think so. Not at this event, but I think I was the only person doing 100 miles. I think everyone else was doing 24 hours. So they were running a much more conservative pace because, you know, they had to be out there twice as long as I did.
Wow. So what are some of the things that happened to you out there? Did you have any stomach issues? Did everything go completely as planned, or did you have some adversity?
So at this event, I actually was probably the best one I've had in terms of stomach issues and getting nutrition down. I typically don't have issues stomach-wise.
Mm-hmm.
I did the one big stomach issue I've ever had was at that 6 days in the dome race I did, where I was trying to get the world record, and I ate something bad the day before, and I ended up stopping like, I think it was like 17 times and like almost 40 minutes of time in the bathroom.
Oh wow!
So like that was that one, the nutrition part of it definitely was my biggest hurdle in that event. So like, and just like I went there to try to run 11:28, and then I ended up running 12:08. So like I knew late enough in the race, like in those hard miles, that I wasn't going to get what I wanted to get. Or even get under my fastest time, my personal fastest time. So that was kind of tough. Then, you know, just dealing with the physical breakdowns you get from, you know, running into the bathroom 17 times.
Yeah, that is crazy.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, other than that, you know, I haven't had a lot of issues with nutrition in general while I'm racing. I think I only stopped twice to use the bathroom at Desert Solstice this year. So.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, that's not like the trail where you can just kind of...
Any bush is a friend, right?
Yeah. But, or just... You can't be as quick.
When
really
I said you're exposed, you're completely exposed.
Yeah. So tell us a little about your nutrition. What were you eating? Mm-hmm. How did you dial that in? And
yeah, so in my normal training and day-to-day life, I try to get my body in a place where it's going to be able to metabolize fat at as high a rate as I can without sacrificing performance. Mm-hmm. So I don't argue that carbohydrate is an incredibly fast fuel source. In fact, it's a very, very good fuel source. But it's also one that your body can only store in small amounts compared to fat. Mm-hmm. So if you can train your body to access fat stores, which even the leanest athletes have much more fat storage calories than they do glycogen calories. Mm-hmm. So in my training, I will eat what I would call a high-fat diet, where the majority of my macronutrients are coming from various types of fat sources. And my protein sources are very moderate, and my carbohydrates are relatively low. And then I start to use the carbohydrates strategically when I'm doing key workouts and in racing to get that you know, what I like to call a high octane fuel source. But by getting my body in a place to be able to metabolize fat at a very high rate, it makes me have to take in less carbohydrates, because then at some of those more like moderate paces, my body just is not using very much glycogen, so I don't need to replace as much of it on race day. So at Desert Solstice, I was taking in a combination of a few different things. I use a product called X-Endurance that makes it's a carbohydrate source called Fuel 5 that basically has four carbohydrates and then a lactate fuel source that all release kind of at a various rate. So I was kind of just trickling that in. I used yerba mate tea. A cold brew tea that had a little bit of sugar and a little bit of caffeine. I kind of trickled that in.
I like that stuff.
Yeah, it's really good. I just think the caffeine from that affects differently than like coffee caffeine for some reason. It's much more like steady, calm sense of energy that I get from it. So I was taking that in, like just kind of trickling it in throughout the day. I used Vespa Power Products as well, which is a wasp extract that's supposed to help encourage your body to metabolize fat at a higher rate. So that coupled with my training and my diet, that would also increase that just to be at as high of a fat burning rate as I could get. And then I just grabbed some random stuff off the aid station when it looked good. Like I think I had some like gummy bears or like some M&Ms along the way as well, when they looked like they were appealing.
So how many calories per hour do you think you were ingesting? And did you stay consistent throughout the race or did it fluctuate?
I traditionally, in most of my races, I'm usually around 150 calories an hour, somewhere in that ballpark.
Wow.
A lot of it ranges on the pace I'm going, because no matter how fat adapted you are, the faster you go, the more you're skewing towards glycogen carbohydrate. So sometimes in those faster races, I'll take in slightly higher amounts, unless it's so short that my glycogen stores are enough to cover me. At Desert Solstice, I think I ended up taking in probably a couple hundred calories an hour, which is probably a little more than what I normally would do, but I didn't really have any stomach issues or anything, and it didn't feel like I was bonking, which is what I would get if I was doing too many carbohydrates and my body was going through these like peaks and valleys from glycogen depletion and glycogen replenishing and stuff like that. So I was just kind of taking things in when it felt right, and that came out to be about that.
So, Anne, I'm going to ask you about your calorie consumption in races, but first I want to ask you, Zach, about what clues do you receive that I need to bump up my carbohydrate here a little bit? I'm usually at 150, but now I'm going to go 200 or 250. What is your body telling you so that you'll increase it?
I guess as I get – so I've been doing the high-fat thing for a little over 4 years now. So it's almost something that you notice what isn't there. And what isn't there is all these biosignals to refuel. So – I don't necessarily know that I'm feeling a whole lot that says like I don't feel always like, oh, I'm feeling low, like lightheaded or like what some people would call a bonk.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really get those mentally. Like I can easily physically break down if I go out too hard. In fact, that's likely what happened to me at Desert Solstice near the end. But, for me, it's like, I kind of have an idea of the race, the pace I want to go and where my ratios of fat metabolization to carb metabolizations are, and I try to at least somewhat replicate what I've seen on paper from those from lab tests and things like that into what I'm taking in a race. And some of it, you know, you have to be careful because obviously a race is in a lab setting, so there's a lot of like variables that aren't accounted for there. So some of it is like, you know, a little bit, I guess, a little bit by by feel or just noticing, like, okay, I'm running. Like at Desert Solstice, I did run some laps that were close to 6 minute pace, which were probably ill advised. But I know that by going down to 6 minute pace, I'm increasing my carbohydrate or my glycogen burning compared to doing like a 7 minute or a 7:30 pace. So just knowing that and seeing those splits kind of lets me kind of know this is about the rate I need to take in. And some of that's by past performances. Like I think of some of my better races and I look at the number of carbohydrates per hour or calories per hour that I took in. And I use those. Well, this was a good race. This is what I did. So obviously that was working for me.
Yeah, that's interesting to kind of watch your own performance and what's happening, knowing that if you're driving faster in your car, you know, you're going to burn more fuel. So you're going to end up pulling over a little bit quicker. So you kind of watch your performance and know I better add a little bit here.
For sure.
Instead of waiting for things to show up, you just anticipate things are going to go south unless I add a little bit more.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm interested in asking you, Ann, because you know, we're close to the Western States Trail here, and there are more cougars in this home than there are out on the trail. And so you have great experience of watching calories. So what did you or do you watch out there to keep yourself even?
I just set my watch. Every 30 minutes it beeps, and I take 100 calories. It's simple.
Yeah. Regardless, that's...
That's what I got used to. And I mean, they've done studies like, I don't know what size person, but there's only so much you can digest in an hour.
Yeah.
And to me, 200 to 300 works well. But what I find that I really like carbohydrates and I performed better on that. And I just knew that if I... that 100 calories an hour every 30 minutes, I wouldn't have the fluctuations because you don't have the insulin, the responses and all this stuff. So that's when I didn't have to take jelly beans and I could do goo. I mean, honestly, we're talking like serious things have really improved. You can just take a goo. Before it was like you're like counting jelly beans or M&Ms. Like, okay.
So you're like, there's this many calories and X amount of jelly
beans. Yeah, of course.
one handful of jelly beans.
Yeah, and you would because you know you're going to feel like you'd be like, oh, man, I have to eat these. And now you can like, okay, I don't want to do this, but I'm just going to suck this goo down. And then I'll, you know, it's a lot better.
I think I think that's one of the things that have is really changing, I think, or at least for me, observing, is that stomachs are usually a thing that takes a person out of a race. You know, when the stomach goes, then the mental chatter becomes negative, and then, you know, the muscles don't get their glycogen they need, and then you end up feeling sluggish, and then the rest goes.
But these track races, what also can get you is the tendonitis and not training in the proper shoes and getting, because when I did that, that's why I would go to the track. And I would do like 20 miles just because I didn't want like some, just the way you lace your shoes. I don't know, maybe your shoes did not. It depended on how you laced them. If you had certain pressure and just that repetitive, because you don't get that out on the trail. And so to me, a lot of the tendonitis takes people out more than the stomach issues. Cause, I mean, especially like if you're doing a 6 day or some crazy thing like that. Yeah. Although, I mean, a lot of people love that stuff. But yeah, they have more problems with, you know,
mechanical.
It's more repetitive mechanical type
stress. I couldn't imagine doing 6 days because they
don't knock it unless you try it.
Well, I've tried to walk after.
Have you done a 6 day?
No, but I've helped people do it. And Amari Boyd just did it.
Yes.
And she set the Australian record. She's 67. She was out there. Like 311 miles, which doesn't seem much, but you try doing 50 miles a day for 6 days.
I've tried to walk after a race the next day. It's not easy. Total respect for somebody doing it the next day.
And her feet, but there was another Perth, a couple people that had, they have like, that's a big issue, especially like the 6 day in the dome. I heard that was like cement.
The surface is huge.
But in a dome, so that means there's no fresh air. You're not outside?
Right.
Is it covered?
Didn't you have like entertainment? Wasn't there soccer games going on?
There was soccer games and there was actually like a birthday party that went on too.
Oh, that helps.
And we have one here too.
Because apparently the dome was also some kind of, I guess you could rent it out. So they had enough room to rent it out to us and this birthday party, which was actually pretty cool because there was
entertaining.
Probably like, and there was like, I want to say like 30 probably middle school age kids that started to kind of get excited by this little like, this event going on, and they would stand there and cheer and like and kind of like give you like a little bit of a different experience when you're coming around the track as compared to.
I just can't imagine. Okay, we're talking Alaska in the summer. The last thing I'd want to do is have a birthday party inside.
I know.
Well, maybe the mosquitoes were so bad. We're going to have it in the dome, so we stay away from the mosquitoes.
The dome race is you step outside the dome and just look, you could see the mountain range. Right, and you're like, we're going to be in here. Well, the guys who were doing 6 days, we're going to be in there for 6 days. And like, we're like a hop, skip, and a jump away from some of the most spectacular trails and mountains you can find.
Exactly.
I've got to think that not tracking the day, seeing the sun come up, it's in the middle of the sky, now it's going down. Mm-hmm. Just being in a sanitary environment without any watching the day move through would create some insanity.
Yeah. I mean, I can't speak from experience, but it was definitely different being in that environment compared to being outside, where even at like desert solstice, I saw the sun not come up because it was already partly up, but I saw it like change throughout the day on directions of the sky and then ultimately set. So like, you know, you could kind of get that sense of time of day, whereas in the dome it was like it was what it was.
Yeah, but Zach, you only ran 11 hours and 40 minutes. Okay, how hard is that, right?
I did 12:08 in
the dome. But Joe, how he was out there for six days.
I know.
And he's a beautiful runner. So are you. I mean, watching someone like Joe, because I did this like thing out in Tennessee. I mean, I just can't believe whatever Laz comes up with we do. But
Ball State.
That's like Ball State. Talk about that to me is crazy.
Yeah.
Let's like run across Tennessee without aid in July with a bunch of like dogs. I mean, these people like seriously think it's bad. They were like, you have to have an umbrella when you do Ball State. Did you know that?
No, I didn't hear
the umbrella story. The umbrella, you because the sun gets to you and you have to ward off the stray dogs.
So it's like a two for one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It comes in handy for two
shade
items.
And weapon.
Oh. Shade and weapon. And people like he comes up with these things. You think that the Barkley was bad? The guy just keeps. I love the guy. It's like, but the problem is,
he's an evil genius.
He's an evil genius.
Yeah.
He really is, and people will do it. You know, if he comes up with it, people will. You should.
And
try
I think
that.
You need to start doing stuff like that.
I did. I feel do like one of his. People, not.
Like, no, I think
Barkley?
You should be directing.
No, not Barkley.
You should be directing some.
Oh,
some
I'd love to do. I thought what he did that run for the ages.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That was cool. Brilliant. Because you couldn't get those many people to do like a reunion.
Uh huh.
So it was like a reunion of all these people. And it, I don't know if people know, but it was like you get an hour. It was all stage started by your age. So everyone finishes at the same time. So because I just turned 55 and we know I'm old, I got 55 hours. But there was like a guy out there for 84. So they're all at different. And the whole time people are starting at different times.
Oh.
But, you know, I was just talking. And then talk about talking, have gritting conversations. I mean, you know, you just. It was like people I hadn't seen since the 80s.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And they were all like chatting. And, oh, yeah. Like Tom Possert. He wore the same shorts. I ran a race in 1988, I think, because I did a 24-hour on a 1 mile loop in New York City, and he was in it. And so, and we, I don't, non-bios to me, it's like, talk about someone who needs a life, okay? He's like, oh, we were on the cover of Ultra Running. And then all these people are like, oh, that would be like my dream thing if I was ever on the cover of Ultra Running. So he wanted to repose our picture from when we were on the cover of Ultra Running. And I'm like, dude, man, get a life. And so I think he still had the short shorts. He wore them. Yeah.
He must have been lucky.
Man. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, it was like scary.
Going, so.
But it was entertaining.
And you've run a lot of different types of races. What's your favorite type of race to run? A track race? A trail race? What?
Western States.
Western States.
Yeah. How do you think I put a house
really
on the course?
I don't know.
Question it.
That was the worst question in all the episodes. That was the number one worst question I've ever asked.
A point-to-point hilly mountainous trail run.
All right.
Yeah.
How about you, Don?
Were you expecting to say definitely the track?
I don't know what I was thinking.
Oh, I really want to do a 6 day in the dome.
I didn't see anybody else asking a question. I had to. That was. I just threw it out there.
Leave it to Don.
I took a hit for the team. All right. So my favorite race would absolutely be a point-to-point with plenty of variety in it, where I could go down, I could go up, I can have an excuse. Zach, I can't believe going and doing a race that I'm feeling obligated to always be moving. It's so awesome to have a a climb up Devil's Thumb where I'm absolutely permitted and allowed to hike. In fact, it is prescribed, and that really helps me because I like to change it up. I think running 100 miles consistently on a track, respect
to
you.
Have you tried it?
No, I think I'm afraid to try it.
Maybe you should.
Oh, well, I mean, it doesn't take much to convince me to do something, but yeah. I mean,
if Zach can do it, well, yeah.
Zach's a specimen. I'm across the table. I can see he's capable. Sally, would you run a track 100 miler? Are you listening to this story and saying, you know, maybe I should do this?
You know, I think that's why I love the ultra distance so much. Just ultra and trail, I guess, just kind of go together because the variety and why people are drawn to it is for a variety of different reasons. And I think even just within, the distance that you love, there's 50 different ways to do it. Yeah. When you think about running a marathon, a road marathon, it's like, you can pick the location, but it's all going to be on the road and,
probably
you know,
flat.
And probably flat. So you can be more technical and precise with how you run it. And it is more pure running. But I think the reason why I love, you know, running trails and the 100 mile distances is really my favorite is because I love being in the mountains and I love seeing the world. I mean, the opportunities that I've had in the past couple of years to travel to different parts of the world and run in places that I've dreamed of since I was a little girl. I mean, that's the true, where the passion and the drive and the pull really comes from. So I haven't thought about, you know, there has never been a desire to do a track or a loop. I can't wrap my mind around that. But I think sometimes I do question myself, like, well, because I would never do it, maybe I should do it, you know, and wonder about it.
how can running around a track for 402 laps, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How can that make you a better runner for the next time you go and run states, for instance? Can you use that experience to then enhance your point-to-point mountain race?
I think certain components of it. Just like in terms of like the mental strength and or mental fortitude building like that, any ultra distance is gonna kind of benefit you in that regard.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly helps with like turnover and stuff, the training for it. I definitely do speed work that I would maybe not do if I was doing a mountainous course, which is probably helpful from just keeping like a lot of different stimuluses in your training. And another one I can think of too, and one thing that I've tried to focus on since I started ultra running is doing enough variety that it doesn't ever get stagnant. So like I really love running and I want to be running for the rest of my life. So I try to like keep things fresh mentally so that I don't get to a point where like physically I can still run, but I don't want to mentally. So changing the environment has been kind of a cool way to do that. So I think that would help. That helps too. The fact that, like if I would get into states and train for that race, then it's a whole new stimulus. So I can get excited about that. Like it's there's a lot of different things I would do to get ready for that. And I'm experiencing that right now, even with the races I'm doing, this spring with, Lake Sonoma and Comrades. I mean, Comrades is concrete road, but it's definitely a lot more climbing and descending than I've traditionally done in some of my races the last couple of years. Lake Sonoma is a lot different than a track, obviously, although it is a pretty fast course. But I'll do a lot different training for it. So when I sit down and decide, this is what I need to do to get myself ready for this race, and I look at the workouts I'm going to do, they're different enough where they don't feel super repetitive. Like, oh, I'm doing this training block again, kind of a thing.
Right. Well, and you say longevity is one of your goals, and switching up the types of events is going to provide for that longevity.
For sure.
I guess I'm dialing out. I don't have much longevity left. Sounds like I'm about done. Well, that's good. I guess I can edit that part.
Yeah. No. Is so. What does your race look like? Your race schedule for this year? And you said Lake Sonoma and Comrades.
Yeah. So I always have a little bit of a struggle planning my race, my full season out, because the last couple of years I've done World 100K Championships on the road, and they're never really releasing the specific time and venue until like later in the year. So I usually plan the first half and then wait for that to get released, then plan stuff around that race. But I definitely want to do something between now and Sonoma as kind of a tune-up. Sonoma will be more or less a tune-up for Comrades. Comrades will be my A race. But I feel like just the training I'll do for Comrades will be pretty good training for Sonoma. So, and Sonoma's far enough into the block that I'm hoping to be in pretty good shape by then anyhow and be able to do decent at Sonoma as well. But after that, at some point this next year, I will probably get on a track again for 100 miles and take another swing at that and see if I can get a little bit faster. Yeah, and then I don't know what I'll do this fall or winter. I definitely want to do some more trail racing this year than I have the last couple of years now that I'm living out in California and have access to them. So once I identify some A races outside of Comrades, I'll probably at the very least try to trickle in some trail races as benchmark type races throughout the season.
How much rest do you take? Do you plug in blocks of rest?
Kind of. I always give myself the flexibility for that. So I'm very much a high mileage runner. I always been since college. That's kind of how like I got into the sport, and that's what I found works well for me. So
what's high mileage for you?
So the last 4 years, I've averaged between like 5,200 and 5,700 miles in the year, which doesn't leave a whole lot of time to take significant blocks of time off. Because that comes out to be like around 110, 115 miles a week.
I could do that math knowing that there's 52 weeks. That's a lot of miles.
So, I mean, but the thing is like I very much built myself up to that. And, you know, a lot of that was flat, like paved type stuff. So the miles do like clip off a little quicker on those in those environments. So, I mean, I've adapted to it. And I've watched my nutrition like in what works for me. I think that's one of the big things I've done is I really like to run. So like in a perfect world, I will run 5,000 miles a year. You know, I'm never aiming for that, but that's just kind of what happens when I recover, when I feel like I need to, and I train hard when I feel like I'm ready for it. And then, you know, kind of pick and choose times to really push it and times to step back a little bit. I think a lot of it has kind of come to a point where the act of running isn't super fatiguing for me. So like if I dial back the intensity, you know, recovery phase. So like after Desert Solstice, I said, well, if I want to take the rest of the year off, it was December 19th when that race was held. But I was going to start running as soon as I felt like I wanted to run again, but I wasn't going to run a step further than what felt right.
So how long did you rest? What was that night from the 19th to?
I think I took, it was either 3 or 4 complete days off, and then I started doing just some like real soft running. And I pretty much did soft running for the most part through.
And define soft running for our listeners.
So like just kind of like it's more of a feel than a pace. So like I would go out and I would run and I would never feel like I was raising my heart rate. And I never felt like it was like fatiguing or exhausting. And if I think the one thing I always watch for is mental too. Like I might feel decent, like my legs might feel good, my muscular system might have recovered. But then if I'm running and I get to mile 5 and all of a sudden I'm like, I don't want to be out here doing this anymore. I needed to stop because you need that mental break as much as you do that physical break. So paying attention to that, because the last thing you want to do is, you know, take like a month easy and then, or prescribe yourself a month easy and then not respect it from a mental standpoint, and then get halfway through your training block for your next A race and be fatigued mentally or physically and realize it's too late to go back and rest when I should have rested, because now is not a good time to rest.
I'm sitting in front of Sally, Zach, and Ann, and I've got to think that you guys have an opinion about does the body, I'm sure both of them need to be observed, but I really never thought about the mental side and the physical side of leading and listening to and giving self a break. Even though the body is capable, maybe the mind is a little bit not as enthusiastic about that training and listening to those clues. So
I think like for me too, like the nutritional aspect of the sport has been just as big a part as the actual act of training, along with the recovery, like sleep and all those other things as well. And everyone is different. Like I can't emphasize that enough. You know, you see all these like, you know, go to like, this is what you need to eat. This is what you need to do. But really what you need to do is you need to make yourself educated about what is available in terms of good, healthy foods. And then try stuff and find what works for you. Like when I started ultra running, I very much followed a high carbohydrate diet, and I was starting to burn out. I could tell. So I had a choice to either continue that and scale back on my training and racing and kind of take that route, or look at other avenues to try to continue what I was doing and reverse the, like, you know, the burning out symptoms. And what worked for me was a higher fat approach with strategic carbohydrate usage. That doesn't mean that's going to work for everybody. But that's kind of one thing why I started writing on my blog about that, was because I wanted to outline my journey from square one and continue, because it just definitely evolved. What I'm doing this training block could differ from what I did 2 years ago. So if someone would go and read that entire thing, they could see that evolve as I try things out on myself. It's a big N equals one experiment. And that's my best advice for people trying to find out what works for them, is N equals one, because everyone's
mountains
different.
Yeah. How about you, Sally? It's like, if I need mental like break, I just go to the mountains. And
absolutely.
Yeah. That's why I like my eat mountains for breakfast. Yeah, yeah. That's what I do.
Yes,
how about that for nutrition?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's my favorite. I mean, and I love it, because Anna is so customized in the way that she coaches. She mm-hmm. really gets to know all of her athletes. And so sometimes if it's after like a big training block or after a race, she'll put in the notes, just go enjoy the mountains. Because she knows, like, that's what does it. Just enjoy climbing. You can have fun on the downs. And I'm like, she so gets me. Because it's like, it is. It's like, don't worry about the pace. Don't worry about how many miles you're putting in. Just today I want you to enjoy the mountains. And, you know, because if she said go out there for 8 hours, she knows I would be out there for 8 hours. So if she said,
or do a run today and get so excited and say, oh, I only did like, what, 22, 23 miles. Can I go out and like run like another like 2 hours?
So Anna,
I actually did ask her that today.
Yeah, she did. And I was like, I think Dawn's coming over. It's like,
so Anna, tell me, you coach Sally, for anybody that may not know, what kind of student or athlete is
she's
she?
She's awesome. Uh-oh. No, she is awesome. Yeah, because I mean, it's like, cause, yeah, I mean, I get Sally. I mean, she understands like the mountains. It depends on what rejuvenates you.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. other people are different. You know, it's very personal. And I can relate to that, because after like states or a big event, I would just go to the Sierras and like camp and run for a couple weeks. Yeah. And I'd do a lot of miles. I mean, like a couple hundred miles a week sometimes on the trails. And I'd feel better after that. Just, I think, because mentally you get, I don't know.
So
Anne's a great coach.
Dialing into the right coach that understands. And I imagine that some of your athletes are opposite, different, and you kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? You morph into whatever their needs are.
They're all motivated differently.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I think, such that when you're pushing the envelope, like what Zach's doing, what Sally's mm-hmm. doing now too, is everyone's different, and that's what's the beauty of the sport.
Keeps it interesting.
It keeps it interesting, mm-hmm. and it is totally different. Yeah. I think when you do a marathon, I don't know if it's the same different variety mm-hmm. of what motivates someone.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe it is, and I've just forgotten it.
But I find that we have a lot of the same conversations,
uh-huh.
and I think sometimes I'm like, gosh, she's so great for me, and I kind of feel like a little kid sometimes, because it's, you know, one of the greatest things about having her in my life is she does understand my days and my weeks and all the different things that I kind of juggle, but she is constantly making sure that I take care of myself, because that is what I struggle with.
But that's
with
also what Zach's saying. I mean, Zach's pretty good at taking care of himself. Yes. Yeah, but
yeah. And
I mean, but you have kids and you're, you know, and it's different. It's easy to forget yourself.
It is. And just to rest. I mean, we you know, there's, especially when you're training in the mountains and you love them, you do want to be out there all day,
mm-hmm.
and it's fun. And I think, you know, and this has been so great being able to get on the trails this weekend, but you know, I get so giddy and excited that I just want to go out there all day. But she's really good at reminding you, this is the goal, you know, you got to look at the big picture all the time and not get so caught up in, you know, the moment of training, or if you're not feeling good, like sometimes I'll stockpile my training and that's it. I'm going to train three times today because yesterday was a bad training day. And look at her laughing. But I think it's, you know, and she's good at checking in. And I really appreciate that about her. She's very caring.
We hear a lot about quality, quantity, right? I mean, that's an old topic of discussion. But let's talk a little bit about how, for instance, for you, Zach, how much do you really focus on quality over just quantity? You're running some big miles. Are they all really plugged in with purpose as you're working?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, there's a purpose for most of them, but like there's definitely miles that I'm running just for the sake of running because I want to.
And that's
to
a purpose
it.
Too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Because you know, it's and you know, there's, I would say there's a good chunk of miles in my training that maybe I don't need but aren't hurting me necessarily. Uh-huh. I guess a lot they might be called junk miles. But there's a ton of specific miles in there that are catered to whatever event I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Workouts that stimulate different like ranges of your systems and things like that, to prepare specifically that, you know, that I'm going to do even if I don't necessarily want to do them. And, you know, Sally was kind of saying the same thing. Like, Sally would love to be in the mountains every day if she could be. Mm-hmm. But she knows getting on the roads for some key workouts is going to help her perform better in the mountains when her key races come up.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of balance between, all right, this is run for enjoyment, this is run for specific purposes, mm-hmm. Kind of how I balance it. So, mm-hmm. It's different. I think like if I were just running for the sake of running, I'd probably run way more miles, but I probably wouldn't do a whole lot of 400 repeats or anything like that. So, and I also wouldn't be worried about recovering and tapering and stuff like that either. So, it would look different. You know, the miles I hit are, I think, real individual to me and how I've evolved as a runner over the years. And, it's kind of a sweet spot, I guess, in terms of balancing specific miles versus fun miles, when I'm looking at, I guess, my calendar at the end of the year.
I guess we'd have to really define junk miles, but junk miles really are just miles without an exact, here I'm trying to define
pace
it.
Pace or...
Right,
like,
yeah. And I guess what I would do, like, for what I call them for my own training and for my clients, is I'll prescribe a day that's called a DOC or a distance of choice.
Oh, yeah.
So it might be like, for example, I might have a hard workout in the morning where I'm running 15 miles at like a specific pace. And then I don't necessarily need to run another 45 minutes at the end of the day. But if I feel really good and I mentally want to, I have that option. So distance of choice, the way that is defined is I could go out and start running and realize after a half a mile, yeah, this was a bad idea, and scratch it, not do another step, and not feel guilty at all about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could go out and feel really good and end up running for an hour, hour and a half, or something like that, and just, you know, kind of really tuning into what your body's telling you and what you're ready for at the time.
And is there room for junk miles in training, do you think? And we're using junk miles in the right context, right? We're not saying miles that don't count for something, because maybe those junk miles are a mental release. Maybe it's just joy of running, you know. Mm-hmm. So with that definition of junk miles, is there room for that, do you think?
You know, I kind of look at more like every day, especially if I'm doing someone's schedule, there is a purpose, like recovery. So mm-hmm. I will put in like the reason you're doing, because I like want to educate people, at least have them dial in what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, every day does have a purpose. I mean, even if you're going out and doing like call a shakeout run or something, is mm-hmm. a recovery, allowing yourself to do that. And some people aren't very good at it sometimes.
Okay.
Did you see that?
I saw her looking right at you. She didn't look at me. She didn't look at Zach. She's looking at you.
She'll run 4 hours later. Yeah. Is that what it
is? So in the context of junk miles, there really are no junk miles as long as you define that activity has some purpose. Everything has a purpose.
I guess
and some
right?
parameters.
Yeah.
Everything
some
has
parameters.
A purpose.
Like
yeah.
like I said, like the parameters on the distance of choice or the junk miles would be that if your body gives you that signal, this is a bad idea, you listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Yeah, I think you'd be a great coach, Zach, in the fact that I think the next step is really dialing in that nutrition, becoming a fat-burning beast, as Brad Kearns talks about in the book Primal Endurance. We just had him on the podcast, and he features you on it. In his book, And I think that learning to burn fat and be efficient is really a good step for endurance racing and through the mountains, and learning to pull from your own fat stores instead of just fueling yourself through the goo packets and into the stomach. And so I think with your experience and multiple years of doing that, I think you have a lot to share with the community. I think it's good.
Yeah, it's definitely been a fun kind of, I guess, like side passion as opposed to just the actual act of running, was kind of learning about that stuff, researching it, and then applying it to myself and finding out, you know, what nutritional strategy is going to work for me as opposed to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Running for Team Ultra right now, correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They are an up and coming shoe. It seems like just recently at a local race, it seemed there were many ultras out there going up and down the trails. Yeah,
it's certainly been fun. I've been running for them for a couple of years, and now I work for them as well. And it's just been really cool to see that that company grow, and the guys behind it kind of take what their dream or what they believed in when people were literally laughing at them about it, and turn it into something that's becoming a very, very credible, very, very popular choice for a lot of people.
Awesome. Well, good. Sally, what's next for you? What do you have coming up on your schedule? What are you doing? You know, you're busy with Nike.
Yeah, busy doing that. But I mean, like last year, this time of year, all I think, eat and breathe and dream about is Western State. So that is the A goal. Everything I do before that is just in preparation for that. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of looking at these next few races as just fun races and really making sure that I have nutrition dialed in and I'm fast through aid stations, make sure the gear's all dialed in. But I'll do that Italy race that I did last year again, the Siachi Trail.
Nice.
In March.
Uh-huh.
I'll do Lake Sonoma. And maybe do a 50K in there somewhere. I'm not sure. I would just like to... I told Anna I was just going to move in with her, actually.
It's only if you bring your children.
Yes.
How about you, Dom? What are you doing? You did so well at Rio. I can't believe we're not talking about that.
We had a podcast. Yeah, we did talk about that.
It wasn't a purposeful podcast. I didn't really say, let's do a podcast about me. I think
and then he totally turned it around on us. So we actually only talked about it for like 4 minutes, I think.
And then I edited two minutes of it out.
Are you doing any local races up here?
You know what? I want to do... Candace Bird has been talking to me about this 200-mile race.
Ooh, wow. Oh, nice. You going to do the Tahoe?
Tahoe, yeah.
Oh,
I'm
nice.
Not signed up. She's working on it.
And, awesome.
And that's why I'm interested in that, on the fat-burning thing. I think that's, you know, for something that's slow, ongoing, I think that would be key for me. Mm-hmm. And not trying to fuel myself completely with simple carbohydrates going down the throat. I really need to try to use some fat stores to do that. So I'm interested in that race, yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's
exciting.
That'd be fun.
So, that'd be fun.
How about you, Ann? What's happening? What are you doing?
I'm gonna go out just to watch and do the Red Hot in Moab.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really thought much after that.
Awesome. I know you're coaching a lot of people out there, and are you still open for some coaching? Are there some slots available? Where,
yeah, I'm also I brought in Dan Williams. So
oh
it's like
yeah, he's
really
awesome.
Fun.
Yeah.
So and he's it's really nice because he was like my mentor.
Uh-huh.
And it's been really fun kind of journey. It's a different kind of journey. So I'm like we're working together and kind of like just.
He's
and he helped me with the overlook. So mm-hmm. That's the other thing I put on this little. Zach was kind enough to run the 30K there. That was really cool.
I got to say that event was a blast.
Like, he did so. It was so fun. Like, he just takes off, and everyone's like, I think he was, like, doing sub-5-minute miles at the start. And I'm like,
it helps when you give us that nice 2-mile downhill.
Yeah, it was like, he was gone. It was like, yeah. The problem with having someone as fast as Zach, you start, and you're like, I got to get to the finish and set it up, because that dude's going to get there before I drive.
Get to the finish, get to the finish.
I know. It's like, holy moly.
No, but I think with the overlook, like, people who are really excited about the Western States course or the event or, you know, I mean, if you're a first-time applicant, you have, like, less than 4% chance of getting in. Sign up for the Overlook 50K or 30K and experience a great spot of the Western States course and get to see all that in a really well-organized event.
It's really the sweetest.
Fantastic commercial right there.
It's authentic, though. I mean,
it is.
It's the sweetest spot of the race, right? It's through the canyons.
Is, yeah.
Well, no, it starts at Forest Hill, and it really follows the horse course, but you get to go, and it's an easier little river crossing.
Uh-huh.
but it's just
Cal Street.
Yep, that Cal loop? Street, the 50K. You do the Cal Street, and then you cross where the horses cross, Poverty Bar, which is it's shallower. So, and then you just kind of do like where Cool, you know, like Quarry Road, kind of. It's pretty flat. But
that is probably one of my all-time favorite. If I had one run to do, and they said you only get to do one more, it would be that course because it is just so awesome. It is the best.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
It was so green out there today.
Oh yeah, they did a nice run out there today on the course, and the rivers are all flowing, and
it's gorgeous.
It's nice.
Good. What's coming up for you, Zach?
For races, Sonoma and Comrades, I'll probably do something before Sonoma, but I haven't identified yet. And then kind of plan after that.
Good. And we can find you at your blog. What's your blog address?
Yeah. So if you just go to zachbitter.com, my blog is linked to the website. I try to post like a training recap every month and then some intriguing stuff that I experiment with along the way, whether it be diet or like running related, stuff like that.
Awesome. We'll link it to this podcast, and I would recommend people going there. I went there and ended up printing out a bunch of pages because it's good stuff. Yeah. Sally McCrae can be found at
SallyMcCrae.com.
There you go. And your races are found where, Ann? At?
Trace and Running.
And Trace and Running. Good. Okay. Thank you very much, guys, and go out and run.
Mas.
Perfect.